I will discuss work done in collaboration with José Barbón, which is on the net, and I will also, this would be my main topic, and I'll make a few remarks on work in progress with José Barbón and Ian Kogan. I would like to make several remarks on the issue of holography versus extensivity in the context of the anti-de Sitter conformal field theory correspondence. I will start by reviewing the leading order results. I will discuss the manifestations of holography and its enforcement to leading order. Learning from that case, we will go and study the next two leading order. I'll describe the issues involved and the method which we use in order to evaluate the entropy in that case. I will end by a search for stringy information we have obtained using the anti-de Sitter conformal field theory correspondence, access to strong coupling information of gauge theories, which was not available to us before. But I think we would also like to turn the thing around and try and learn something from gauge theories about gravity and, if possible, about string theory, even though nobody really owes us that in this context we can also learn a lot about string theory. In any case, I will describe a search for that. The way I would like to discuss the issue of holography is by focusing on one aspect of it, and that is finding the effective dimension of the system as exhibited by the temperature dependence of the free energy and the entropy of the system. So one heats the system up, the temperatures which one takes are temperatures which are not too large, so we don't enter into the string scale, but are larger than the Kaluza-Klein scales, and the temperatures should also be such that finite size effects are not important. So one looks, for example, at the free energy, and one looks at the temperature dependence of the free energy, one isolates the power of the temperature dependence, and that is the effective dimension of the theory. One condition or one definition of an aspect of holography would be to find that this effective dimension is smaller than the dimension which one naively attributes to this system. I will focus in particular also on the entropy, and we are working within the approximation which was discussed here many times, where first takes the large n limit and then one expands for each value of n. One considers the strong coupling region. So how does the entropy look as a function of the temperature? From the D-brain side, or from the field theory side, we expect to get the normal behavior of a field theory. That is, if we have a DP brain, we expect the temperature dependence of the entropy to be T to the P. On the anti-de Sitter side, one is instructed to go ahead and do a classical analysis which should confirm the quantum information we have on the gauge theory. Now, there may have been a little bit of a surprise that there is a phase transition involved in this system. When the temperature is below a certain temperature, actually there are no contribution to the leading order in 1 over n, and only above that temperature one obtains a contribution to the entropy and the free energy, and that contribution is indeed of a holographic nature. Even though this is a d-dimensional space, one obtains here P as the effective dimension appearing in the temperature dependence of the entropy. Now, I will discuss mainly what happens when one goes to next to leading order. From the field theory point of view, we don't expect any change. We expect the entropy to behave like T to the P. And the question is, what happens when one now does not a classical estimate, but a one-loop calculation on the supergravity side? What type of power do we expect the temperature to have when we are in a situation that the temperature is high enough? Now, in the process of doing that, we will examine the role that anti-de Sitter feature plays. We will examine the role of, if you wish, the type of dynamical role gravity plays. And we will also try and test the validity of the correspondence to next to leading order in 1 over n. The feature that plays a key role in enforcing the holographic principle is actually the statement that we can have several master fields on the supergravity side. This leaves also a place or a role for gravitational type dynamics. Given a certain boundary on which we want to have the deep brain theory, we are instructed to add all possible manifolds which add on that boundary when we are sitting on the supergravity side. So the background, if you wish, or the topology of the background is not really well defined for, as far as the bulk is concerned. All we know is the boundary on which it needs to end. And then in all our calculations, one has to take into account the fact that several contributions may arise. Now let me review the results to leading order in 1 over n. In that case, one has the full planar toothed approximation for the conformal field theory. This is fully quantum. On the supergravity side, we have a classical theory. So the conformal theory is put on a P+1 world volume, which one chooses a topology of a circle times a sphere. There are two types of manifolds with different topology which end on the same boundary. One is essentially the anti-de Sitter space times the attendant extra manifold, which one can take to be a sphere, for example, if we want to have the maximal type of the supersymmetry and have a group SUN. The other manifold which ends on the same boundary is a Schwarzschild black hole embedded in anti-de Sitter space. The X1 manifold has the following topology, while the anti-de Sitter black hole has this topology. The one feature of the X1 manifold is that it can be well defined for any temperature. So when the circle could have any radius. On the other hand, the black hole, in order to be non-singular, may only have a temperature larger than the minimum temperature addressed here, where B is the curvature of the anti-de Sitter space, which we know that in our limits for various types of objects, it has the following behavior on the Planck scale and on N. The metric of the anti-de Sitter manifold is the following. The main feature which we will need is the fact that the scale of the anti-de Sitter curvature and the scale of the extra attendant sphere is the same. Now, if one looks at this, one realizes that one has a local temperature. The temperature is redshifted. Beta 1 over the temperature becomes very large as R becomes large. The radius of the sphere SP becomes proportional to R as R becomes very large, and the ratio respects the conformal structure of the theory. The black hole manifold is given by the following metric. Its main feature, as I said, is that there is, in order that this configuration of this manifold be non-singular, the horizon needs to be related to the temperature in a certain manner, and there is a minimum value for R naught and the maximum value for beta, which means a minimum temperature. Notice that if there would be any sense to take P to infinity, which there isn't, that effective temperature would actually be infinite and we wouldn't have that configuration. The next stage in the mapping is to evaluate the relative contributions of each of these manifolds to any one of the objects one wants to calculate. In particular, we will concentrate here on the free energy and on the entropy. Now, due to the special geometrical structure of the manifold, the action is proportional to the volume. So one has here the volume of the sphere SP, one has the volume of the attendant sphere, and then one has the specific features related to the anti-de Sitter space. Now, the anti-de Sitter space may have a problem at two edges in principle. It may have an infrared problem from the point of view of the nomenclature of R. So for R very large, this may need it to be regulated, and one may also need to regulate this for R very small. Notice that the free energy is proportional, or the explicit temperature dependence appears here linearly in this term. Now, as long as the temperature is low, so that beta naught is larger than beta maximum of P, only the manifold X1 exists. So in that case, there is only one contributor to all thermodynamical functions. And in that case, we face the issue of regulating that manifold. From the point of view of small r, there is no need classically that r be not zero, so one just sets it zero. And one remains here with r max, which in principle should go to infinity. However, all this term here has now only this temperature dependence, and therefore it's essentially a vacuum energy contribution, and it will not give rise to the to any type of entropy. So to leading order in 1 over n for low temperatures, there is no contribution to the entropy. Now this motivated people to study actually what happens on the conformal field theory side or on the gauge field theory side, and then they realize that there may well be there a Gross-Witten like phase at finite volume but infinite n. As one increases the temperature, though that beta naught is smaller than beta max, both x1 and x2 contribute, and one needs to evaluate the difference between them to realize which is the dominant one. Now in this case, there is no problem using the infrared or the large R regulator, and it cancels out of the difference, and all which one remains with is the cutoff at small r of the black hole type manifold. So r naught, which has appeared at the black hole, appears here in this difference of entropies. So if one, it turns out that even though x2 exists, it doesn't immediately take over, and there is a region of temperatures when beta naught is smaller than beta max but larger than this form, or r naught, the horizon, is smaller than B, the curvature, in which X1 continues to dominate and there is no leading order contribution to the entropy. However, the moment the temperature is high enough so that beta naught is smaller than this quantity or R naught is larger than the horizon, in that situation X2 dominates and one obtains the following free energy. The extra temperature dependence had come out, is coming from the small r cutoff which the horizon imposes. So at this stage we are not linear in beta, so when we are going to derive the entropy, the result of the entropy is going to be non-vanishing. And indeed, the to leading order in 1 over n for high enough temperature, for example for the case of the D3 brain, one obtains that the entropy behaves like T to the 3, which is a holographic behavior. But here the issue of holography was holography versus zero. The naive calculation gave zero, and the classical calculation gave the holographic dependence. This is a by now standard case of counting by counting microstates evaluating the entropy of a black hole. Let us now next go, however, to the one-loop approximation. Now, from the point of view of the conformal field theory, it is clear there's nothing special happening at the one loop. From the point of view of the Tuft expansion, this is the torus one is sitting on, and one doesn't expect anything special to happen. The question is how to reproduce that in the supergravity formalism. So now, in a sense, one is inventing a little bit the rules. So the rule here is that if you do, we want to follow that if you calculate one loop on the side of the conformal field theory, you also want to calculate the one loop in the supergravity side. And that means calculating the complete fluctuation kernel around a given manifold X. And the question will be now, when one does that and one heats up the system, will we see the true dimension of the system, what looks the naive dimension of the system, or will we continue to recover the behavior, the temperature power to be P? So the question is, what will we observe at high temperature? I want to note that the n dependence on the supergravity side is only included in the background. The number of species is not dependent on n, just like when one has the duality between quarks, gluons, and hadrons. On the hadron side, you don't see the n. And the problem, a question of this nature, was raised by Horowitz and Toguri. Now, the method we used to evaluate The free energy to one loop is a method due to Gibbons, Perry, and Docker and Kennedy. The basic idea is you have some curved background, you break it into many cells, you define at each cell a local temperature, that local temperature would be appropriately redshifted, and then in some WKB approximation, you take each cell to be an essentially flat space, and you calculate the free energy by integrating over all space of all of the free energy as it looks in each separate cell. This is the way to evaluate the which we evaluate the free energy. Now, if we look at the integrand as a function of n, that is a local redshifted free energy, one obtains the following form, that's a standard form. And now let us consider, for example, what happens when the product of the mass to 1 over the temperature is a large number. In that case, we see that the massive states, which are not excited, exponentially decouple, and you only see the ground state. So in that case, you don't see the extra dimension. Now, M in general is some mass gap of the problem. We could consider, but we are not discussing when the mass gap is associated with 1 over the string scale. What we are interested here is to see what happens when the mass scale is 1 over the Kaluza-Klein radius, and because that's where we are heating up the system. Now, a Kaluza-Klein threshold is reached whenever the temperature is high enough, so the local beta times the local mass gap of the Kaluza-Klein will be smaller than 1. If that is not the case, if the local temperature is not that large, then the extra effective dimension will decouple, and what will remain is a massless free energy in the effective volume of that system. So considering that, one finds that the free WKB energy has the integral of the following form, which may be rewritten by extracting the beta dependence, which will describe what are the effective dimensions of the system. From here we'll get the temperature dependence, times the volume. But the volume is not going to be the true volume, it's going to be what is called the optical volume. That means the volume as seen by light rays, or the volume as measured by the radio, by the metric which is appropriately redshifted. So now let us go and do the one loop calculation. So the one loop optical metric of X1 has the following form. I've divided the original metric everywhere by G00, and now this allows us to evaluate the total effective volume of X1, express it in terms of a parameter Z, where Z is R over B, and in particular one can also look at the subcomponent, which is the anti-de Sitter part of that. Now, the local temperature is larger than the Kaluza-Klein threshold for the attendant sphere whenever the local temperature is large enough, so it obeys this inequality. So, as I said, whenever we cross a Kaluza-Klein threshold, the local temperature is larger than the local Kaluza-Klein threshold for the attended manifold. For large local temperatures, this is expressed in a very simple form. R along the throat should be smaller for B squared over beta naught whenever we are beginning to excite the Kaluza-Klein modes. The opposite happens whenever R is large. Whenever R is larger than B squared over B naught, the effective dimensions drop, the Kaluza-Klein modes are frozen, and we don't excite them on MD to the minus P. So after realizing that, we evaluate the full one loop calculation for around X1, and there are two pieces. One piece was the piece for large R, where one obtains indeed a power P for the temperature. One can substitute this afterwards for R over B beta, as I explained in the original transparency, and one identifies the power P, which is the holographic power. However, from down the throat, from the region from Z equals zero to B over beta naught, one sees an extensive behavior. One sees back the full power of the dimension. So is this a clear violation of holography? The situation is, for large R, the optical volume is finite, and asymptotically, the X1 anti-de Sitter space receives no extensive contribution. However, X1 is extensive for the region between 0 and B squared over beta naught, which is, from the point of view of the gate theory, part of the infrared, which is something which we need to understand. Now, that means that the X1 manifold, left on its own, with no gravitational dynamics on the supergravity side, would not enforce the holography principle. However, so if you wish, the anti-de Sitter feature was not enough. You are anti-de Sitter, but you are still, like in, expected in a field theory, you will see the full dimensions. However, when you go to large temperature, where T is larger than T0, then it is X2, the anti-de Sitter black hole, which dominates. And now, as I said, the interplay of the gravitational aspects have come to play. So we are now in a situation, which is almost a summary, which says the following. If we want to evaluate the one loop in X2 by similar methods, let's consider what happened at X1. At X1, this is a throat as a function of R. When R was larger than B squared over beta naught, we were holographic. When it was smaller, we were extensive. The X2 has an horizon. The horizon will cut a region which is smaller than it. It so happens, or not so happens, but that is a construction, that horizon is of the same scale as the Kaluza-Klein cutoff. So when you cut off the system, you cut off also all the extensive contributions which would have excited the Kaluza-Klein modes. And in this way, the system obeys the holographic principle. Now, from the point of view of string theory, we are not 100% satisfied, because we would like to be able to somehow know what happens by just giving us, if you just give us the worksheet background, we would like to already, just by that data, to be able to decide, is this system holographic or not? Now, it would be nice if, for example, C effective would just be the effective dimension. It's not obvious, however, at all that that is the case. And one should also remember that the supergravity background seems to indicate that because of the topology change, we can't content ourselves with one background. There are actually two backgrounds involved. So around which calculation are we going to do our string calculation, under which background? So there must be somehow a non-perturbative way in which these states are mixed, tunneled to one another, or something which will enable us to understand the picture from the worksheet point of view. As we have here a competition between two effects, one is very large and one is very small, and as I just emphasized, that both X1 and X2 contribute, one may ask, is it not possible that you are in a situation where finally, even though there are two contributions, one extensive, and the one extensive is dominating by large powers of n squared, doesn't it happen when you do a 1 over n correction that eventually takes over? So in order to understand this crossover phenomena, you have to estimate the temperature at which the crossover phenomena occurs. It turns out that that temperature is of the Planck, as long as the grain P is larger than 1, it occurs on the Planck scale or on the string scale, that is, it occurs at a situation where we are outside the region of our validity. So from the point of view of what we discuss, we don't have to be afraid of a crossover phenomena. From the point of view of short distance effects, one can also analyze that, and they also behave in a holographic manner. As I said, the last point I would like to discuss is the issue of a search, as in any experimental talk the name would imply. You understand what the result of the search is. So this is a search for Hagedorn effects. Now, if the boundary, consider the boundary which is S1 cross S3, one finds that in that case, X1 may support loops of order the string scale, which is the indication that Hagedorn-like effects in the temporal direction may occur. However, it turns out that that happens, again, only for temperatures which are of the order of 1 over the string scale. So, that is, you have to heat the gate system as much as you want to heat up the string system, and you can't learn anything because the validity of the gate theory approximation is broken down. So, it doesn't teach us, in that case, about the string theory. Also, we should remember that for high temperature, anyhow, X2 took over, and all that region of space, it turns out, which contains these small loops, is shielded by the horizon. So we got what we call Hagedorn censorship. This correspondence doesn't want to tell us in this topology about the Hagedorn transition. One may envisage changing the topology of the world volume in order to assist the formation of loops at low gauge temperatures. This you can do by changing the topology into S1 cross T3. In that case, there are analogous X1 Twiddle and X2 Twiddle manifolds. It so happens that these manifolds have a singular behavior. One of them, to our advantage here, would be that loops of order LS exist on X1 for any gauge theory temperature. X2 in this situation exists for any temperature. There's no minimum temperature for it to exist. However, what happens is that lambda, that for strong coupling, the region in which one relies on the calculation, nevertheless, when you do the full analysis, the tensorship persists. When you go to weak coupling, for which the approximation breaks down, then Hagedorn effects could have been exposed. But then one needs to speculate, and this we haven't yet finished writing the paper, so I invite you to look at it there. In a sense, in a continuation of the talk maybe of Lenny and David yesterday, I would say that maybe for many years we have practiced and learned that to search for more than meets the eye. We search for anomalies, we search for quarks, we search for solitons, much more than meets the eye. Now it seems the shift is we have to search for much less than meets the eye.
We have time for a few questions. Lee?
So, will there be a regime in which the whole theory will be approximated by a sum over still more manifolds to the bulk with string calculations done for background theory on those manifolds?
Could you speak up? I don't hear you. Maybe you can repeat
I heard
question.
Part of it, but it's a little long. Will there be a regime where the theory...
Will there be a regime in which you have to go past those two manifolds and consider the sum over all
okay.
manifolds?
Well, yes, will there be a regime where you have to go past these two manifolds, I guess what? X1 and X2, and sum over further manifolds?
When the boundary was S1 cross S3, there were only these two manifolds. One can imagine other situations where there are more manifolds and there would be more transitions.
Other questions? Okay, well, that's... Am I missing anyone? Okay, well, thanks. We'll thank the speaker again.